Shalom. Good morning. This is Radio Shalom coming to you through Planet 104.6 FM. Good morning, Carvin.
Ah, thanks, John. Good morning to you.
Well, it's good to have you back in the studio after, I think, too long a gap.
I know, about a year.
So let's catch up with you. What's been happening to you?
Oh, my goodness. Where do I start? Okay.
At the beginning.
I'll start at the... Okay, well, the beginning is that many years ago, over 20 years ago, I wrote a piece of music that inspired me to make a film. And the short version is I made a stop motion animated film, and so for the past year that has been out hitting the film festival circuit, and so that it's been projected in festivals in the U.S. and in Italy. I won some awards at the Turin Festival.
Mazel tov.
Thank you. And then on the 15th of May. My film was played at the Cannes Festival.
Double mazel tov.
Thank you. It was in Palais B, which is like the second largest of the film festival venues in Cannes. And I'm saying that wrong because everyone here tells me it's Cannes. So in Cannes. But it was on the same day and the same screen as Yellow Submarine, about an hour before they projected the newly restored Yellow Submarine and give it an achievement award, because it was a highly neglected film in the intervening years since the time it was released and the time it was done. Incidentally, I should point out that Yellow Submarine was designed by a Jewish artist named Peter Max. And so, so you get a lot of that, you know. So it was kind of nice that my film got to be there the day that Peter Max got honored for the work on his film. And so I felt that like a double honor, not just being played at Cannes, but also getting that little bit of an extra Jewish solidarity boost.
And what about the Beatles? Don't they get a mention?
Oh, of course they get a mention. they get mentioned from here to Sunday. So you know what? Where would we be without them? Don't get me wrong. I do not mean to diminish them, but if you look at the history of the Beatles, it's nice to see that they had a bit of Jewish help all along the way, and that should make us all feel a little bit proud.
So you can clap in that house.
Yeah, indeed. So. But about my film, more about me.
That's what we're here for.
Well, good. I should start off with how the piece of music began
Did you write?
How that happened.
How long ago did you write it?
1995. In fact, I can tell you the exact date that I finished writing it was October 13th of 1995. And
in the States.
In the States. I was living in Los Angeles, and in fact, at the time, I was very busy doing some design for a Dot Ariel in the San Fernando Valley. So I was up to my neck in my community and very happy about that. I was trying to break into film composing, and as you know, I've got my foot in the door and wiggled it around a bit over the years. But at the time, I was really working hard to get my foot in that door, and I had read in one of the classifieds that were handed out to music industry people that someone was looking for a composer for their horror film, and so I called them up, and they said, "Well, the deadline for the demos is next Tuesday," and. And I said, "Great. Well, what's the film about? We can't tell you that. Can you send me a script or a treatment? We can't do that." So I had absolutely nothing to work on.
And except so I thought that it had to be horror.
Except that it had to be music for a horror film. So I wrote these themes, and the two things is I always thought that waltz makes a good horror thing, because there's the irony of it's a happy dance tune. And from the Jewish viewpoint, part of why we like a nice minor keyed waltz is it's that reminder that even in our sorrow, we know how to laugh and dance. And that's something that has been a part of our culture for centuries. And so I thought, okay, I'll make it waltz based. And since I, at the time, I didn't know because no one had bothered to tell me that most demos for film scores have to be about 2 minutes long. If you go over 2 minutes, people lose interest. So I wrote this 6-minute waltz that went through all of the possible scenarios that I could think of for a horror film, just one after another after another. And in order to make it extra creepy, I took sections, entire sections I built using the work, the music theory work of Arnold Schoenberg, another Jewish composer, and who was popular about 100 years ago. Popular isn't the right word. Who was famous about 100 years ago because he broke away from using chords and melodies and things that we know of now today. And he was the first to really introduce a numerical mathematical system called 12-tone. And so I thought, okay, I'll just write some 12-tone melodies and 12-tone passages in here to give it just an extra creepy fashion, because when you hear it, it's something that doesn't make sense to the ear initially. It sounds harsh and dissonant, but because of the mathematical nature of it, your brain can recognize that it's a pattern. Something's happening there. I just don't know what it is. And that's a nice and creepy thing. So I thought I'd mix these together. I mixed in some ideas from Stravinsky, not taking his music, but his ideas about how you put two different keys together at the same time. And the remarkable thing, even to me at this time, is that writing this initial waltz, this 6-minute long waltz, took me about 2 hours. And I sat down and wrote it at the piano, and bang, I'm done. And then without hesitating, I went on to orchestrating it and recording it and sent it off. Yeah, the works. I did everything. And so in what was essentially a 4-hour recording session, because I didn't bother to write down any of what I'd done before I got to the recording studio. So 2 hours to write it, another 2 hours to record it. And I sent that off to the film producers. And in about a week, I found out that they'd given the job of composer to the producer's nephew, and I didn't even have a chance. So, and I was just, you know, I was a little crestfallen, but then about 4 months later, I listened to back what I'd done, and I thought, oh, I've actually written a nice little concert work here. But also, it's telling me a story. What is the story it's telling me? And after a couple of listenings, I realized it was telling the story of an old-fashioned funhouse that was a little bit haunted, that was a lot haunted, and it would be old and dilapidated and broken down, because in the modern day, there aren't really very many of those funhouses around. And so in my mind, this thing became a story. I'm just babbling on quite a bit. I'll tell you what we should do. I should, just so you and our listeners get a flavor of what this is.
I think it's a good story so far.
Well, good. We will take up the story again.
Here's a hurdle.
But let's have a little musical interlude here. And I didn't bring the original thing besides that 6 minutes worth of crazy. So what we'll do is I'll play a bit of the end title from my film, which goes through some of these themes, and just kind of, as most end titles in films do. This is the film that I eventually did from this, and we'll get back to the story in a moment. But let's hear some of these themes so that you understand the waltz bit, the scary bit, the part that goes off in this mathematical system. You'll hear all of that go by in the course of a couple of minutes, and then it'll be easier for me to talk about it. So let's go now. We'll be right back. And so I started off writing these themes and turning them into kind of horror themes. And this, and so this story that it told me about the funhouse that you, now you can hear, it's a little bit circus-like. It's a little bit horror. It's a little bit funny because...
And you don't know what's around the next bend.
Exactly. And so after several years of trying to convince my friends in film to turn this into some kind of an animated short, finally, a friend of mine who was working for Disney invited me over, poured some drinks, and said, I'm going to teach you how to animate. And so she taught me the process of animation that they taught old school at Disney. And so timing sheets and all kinds of things that you write down first before you even paint your first frame. And she said, what you need to do is make this as a stop motion film. Forget drawing it. You'll take the rest of your life. So I started building things and...
Explain stop.
Stop motion is when you... take your subject, and in my case, I had we'll start with a puppet, and I'd have the puppet of the clown near the beginning of the film, and say he's going to turn a crank. So you move him a tiny bit, take a picture, move him a tiny bit more, take a picture,
okay.
and then at 24 pictures per second, you've started to create movement. So when you play them back as if they're single frames of a film, things start to move. So yes, this entire thing, it turned out to be almost 20 minutes long of 24 frames per second of shooting on a small, cheap, I might point out, at first a Nikon Coolpix, and then when that died, I got a Canon 230, just little snapshot cameras. I didn't use anything fancy, and the idea from the beginning was when I was you know living as a poor struggling artist in Hollywood, I didn't have a lot of budget to put in this, so it was all done low fidelity and done with recycled materials and things I could find. And so what you're looking at when you see this film is really stuff that you can tell from the moment you first lay eyes on it that it's very handmade. There's not a lot in here that's, you know, nothing looks slick. Nothing looks highly polished like the stop motion films you see right now in the cinemas. The whole point of this is that it has to look old and dilapidated. And the best way to do that was to just go ahead and let the inexpensive cameras roll and let it be cheap. And so
you had to use puppets or drawings.
Puppets. I actually built puppets for all the characters. And full body, like, you know, they move around, they walk.
So it's a one-man show.
It's a one-man puppet show, and it just goes on. And so there are ghosts, and there are walking skeletons, and there are all kinds of things. And my favorite ghost is the ghost of Minerva Wittum is her name. And I should play for you when we first, well... We don't first, we first introduce Minerva in scary haunted house sort of ways like you'd find in any good ghost film. But I'd like to play for you the entrance of Minerva where you first get a really good look at her and a sense of who she might be. So we're going to start with the introduction to Minerva, which is a very emotional string thing, and then play a little bit of her theme. So, this ghost Minnie that recurs throughout the whole film, part of what helps part of the story that she's telling you isn't exactly always her story. So sometimes she's showing you horrible things that happened in the course of this funhouse. And not far after the point that we just heard the music for, she takes you down into the deepest crypts where there is a secret trial going on. And one of the clowns with a rather large nose gets his head cut off. And
I don't like this.
Oh, it's quite horrible. Oh, yeah, it's creepy. But also, it's creepy because you're seeing a miscarriage of justice of someone who is probably innocent getting a most horrible punishment and for who knows what. But it is just, you know, because it is a horror. And you're seeing a play played out by ghosts. And so, as in most ghost stories, you're getting something replayed that is some memory of something horrible that happened in the past. And I made a conscious choice at a certain point to make sure that there is a horrible secret trial with a judge with a gavel, and there is a headsman, so that you know that this is some horrible miscarriage of justice. Because this is something that kind of recurs throughout Jewish history, is that throughout the entire history of Jewry, and especially throughout the history of the diaspora, you find just horrible miscarriages of justice and trumped up kangaroo courts being thrown together to find Jews guilty of all kinds of things. And in my story, it doesn't even matter, because it really has never mattered what it is they were accused of. It's really more about just the miscarriage of justice. And I wanted, you know, I made a point of putting that almost exactly at the halfway point of the film, because that miscarriage of justice does kind of bring about a lot of the ghosts and skeletons in the closet of Western culture. So I know I'm sounding very philosophical about this, what is essentially just a fun house ride. But, you know, I wanted to kind of embed in it throughout the story little elements of what it means to be a Halloween Jew. What it means to be a Halloween Jew is to speak up about injustice, but in a way that is a little bit subversive. I mean, it's a way that people aren't going to immediately think about, except that you recognize that not all the monsters are the ones who are supernatural and human. And inhuman, sorry. My accent again. And and so when you're telling a horror story, and then you want that sense of unnatural, or I'm sorry, of inhuman monsters to sometimes be the humans, and that's what I've done in this. And of course, you're also going to get chased by walking skeletons. I should wrap it up by starting to talk about my orchestra, and also how I gave my next to final movement, because I wrote the score. I broke the score into movements, and so the fourth movement of this little collection I called Die Geisterwaltz, because I thought, you know, if there wasn't enough clues as to my background and my viewpoints, then this would be a little bit of a clue.
A little hint,
you know. So for you Yiddish speakers out there, this is just a little bit of a discovery for you to enjoy that maybe other people might not get. And but when I finished up this film, I took exactly 10 years to shoot it from
Did you play all the orchestra parts?
No, I didn't. I actually got in real players this time, and you know, it started off. You know, it's like when you start to clean a window and you find a little spot on the window, so you clean it, and then you realize you've made a clean spot, so you have to keep cleaning. Well, that's what happened to me. Several years ago, my partner and I were at a concert of the Auckland Philharmonia, and we heard this oboe player named Camille. Camille Wells was the soloist that night, and her oboe playing was so strong and emotional and beautiful that we talked about it. And my partner Deborah, she kept saying to me, "You've got to get that oboe player for this for your score, and you can just do the rest like you normally do, but you've got to get her to play the oboe solo." And so I got in touch with her, and she agreed to do it. And so we got her in, and her playing was so beautiful and so emotional and so very strong that I thought, well, that was great. I wonder if I can get more players from the Philharmonia in, and I wonder who else I can get in. And I had intended to play all the parts myself and fill in things with synthesizers. I ended up using the only synthesizer I used was actually the organ, which sounds like an organ. Mm-hmm. And everything else was played by real players. I did play the theremin solos in it, and I did play some of the drums, but I even hired two different orchestral percussionists for that. And it was an international cast. So some of my string section were from the APO, some were from the Seoul Symphony Orchestra, and some were from, I had the trombone player from Catch a Fire and from the Phoenix Foundation.
And where did you record it?
I recorded this all in my tiny little studio. And it sounds like it's in a small room. I put microphones up in the corners and recorded it as if I were doing a large symphony, except it was in a tiny room. And it was two or three players at a time. Sometimes one at a time. So my upright bass player was from Germany. My part of my woodwind section was from China, and the other part was from the Bolshoi Opera Orchestra. And so let's just roll Die Geisterwaltz, and I'll just describe what's going on here. So in the film, after you've seen this horrible miscarriage of justice, and the camera takes you away like you've run away from that scene because it was too horrible to see, and then you get into a room filled with skeletons and old, what looks like it could have been maybe a torture room or something like that, with just the bones of people all around. You'll notice that now is when the skeleton starts running toward you and the thing. The xylophone there is a guy named Josiah Carr, and he's also a composer here in Auckland. The viola player was from the APO, and I wanted to give those guys some real spotlight as it goes on. So throughout this entire section, you're running through the labyrinth of the funhouse and being chased by skeletons. You'll hear it happen. Let's give it a moment. And it's about this moment the skeletons are just about to catch you. And that's when I decided the audience needs a laugh. And so in kind of the old, I don't know, Warner Brothers cartoon tradition, I thought it was time to give them a little bit of skeletons playing on the xylophone. Or the bone xylophone? On the xylophone. Another part of the Hollywood Jew tradition is remembering now and then to laugh at yourself, and to laugh at yourself for being afraid, and to laugh at and to laugh in the face of oppression, and all of that. That is so important to us as a people, is to remember that sometimes you just have to laugh at it all. And so if some of this reminds you of Carl Stalling's work doing cartoons, then there's a very good reason for that. Now, coming up here, we're about to get the waltz string. Here we go. And this will be the oboe player I was speaking about, Camille Wells. Listen to her.
Mm.
I know we're running out of time, and I'm only just talking about the music, so I promise I will come back and tell you more about how the whole thing came together. But this is...
So this is part one. Part two coming up next week.
Yes. Yes, we'll do that. That's a great idea. Thank you for that. A little Calliope reminder that you're still in a funhouse. Just a little reminder of Minnie.
Your hostess.
Our hostess, our ghost hostess.
Well, that was quite a feat.
Well, thank you.
Carvin, and how many was it, 10 years it took?
It took 10 years to actually shoot it. It was 20 years more than 20 years, nearly 25 years now. From the time I first had the idea. And so this has been kind of my crazy side project for a very long time. And it's odd to live with a piece of music for that long. I think when we came to the end and I had to turn that 6-minute piece into a 20-minute score, it was really a matter of pulling the entire thing apart and going, oh, I have parts here that can go there. And just, you know, it was like I was playing with Legos.
So what made you start now to finish it, because it's been in the ether all this time?
Well, except that it hasn't. It's been in the works for all this time, and that was the problem. I always viewed this as an ongoing project. You know, this is something that was happening. But it was always in the background. It was always, you know, when I didn't have other music projects going, when I didn't have music work happening, I'd be straight back to this. So in the meantime, I mean, I just released an album of dance music at the end of May. And even while I was working on that, I was still working on this film that was all orchestral score, and it was all handmade stop motion things, and sometimes, you know, lit by candles. I mean, I went to stupid lengths to make this thing.
The atmosphere.
Yeah, it was all about the atmosphere. It was all about the vibe. Yeah, it's all about the vibe, Your Honor, as we know here. I think the real question is, why did I keep going on something for so long? And the answer was kind of one part obsession and another part pure determination, just to prove to myself that I could do this and tell this particular story.
Well, you had a lot of patience and belief, I suppose.
Yeah, I think the two go hand in hand, really. It's a lot easier to have patience when you believe in something.
But this comes from different continents.
It does. It does. I wrote the initial bits when I was living in Los Angeles. And in fact, part of it I wrote while I was living in Pasadena, just outside L.A. And I started shooting, so the first two or three shots that I shot, about a minute's worth of this 20-minute film, I shot on the floor of my Hollywood apartment before I moved to New Zealand. And when I was thinking about moving to New Zealand and when I was preparing, I was speaking with my partner about this project, and I said, I think I'm just going to have to scrap it to move. And she said, don't you dare scrap this project. It's worth something. It's worth believing in. You pack up that entire project, you pack up the whole production, and you bring what you have to New Zealand. So the initial kernel of what I did, the characters I built in L.A., continued acting on my miniature stage in New Zealand.
You didn't lose them.
I didn't lose them. I lost bits of the set. There were some things that were just too large to pack up, so I just threw those out. But it means that once you finish seeing those rooms, you never get back to them again in the film. And it really adds to the sense of creating an entire world inside a funhouse, because you move from room to room to room to room. It's not like seeing just a single stage play on a stage.
Thank you very much, Carvin. We will listen to part two next week. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to listen next Sunday at 10:10 to Radio Shalom. And we would like to thank our sponsor, Nature Bee.